Hey everybody, thanks for showing up today. First I'll introduce myself. I'm Timothy Heaney. I am a supportability program manager on the Exchange team. I'm responsible for the new hybrid configuration wizard and a lot of our new migration experiences that are coming.
Hi, my name is Nicholas Blank. I'm a messaging and cloud architect with NB Consult.
You may notice we have a few hashtags up here. We're going to dive into these suckers as some of the topics. But one of the things that frustrates me the most is when people call a hybrid server, because there's no such thing as a hybrid server. People that know me are like, don't do that. So that's why that's up there. And obviously the HCW rocks. So yeah, anything you want to add about that?
No, I'm just happy that we called out the hashtags.
Or the Twitter. All right, so our agenda today, is a little bit unique. One thing we wanted to do was blind you with a white slide. But our agenda today is a little bit unique. Normally with hybrid, we just talk about what's coming and a few common pitfalls, but we don't get into, you know, what life is like when you're running hybrid for a long time, when you're going to stay in a hybrid configuration, what issues you might run into, what things might help you get the most out of your hybrid configuration and the most out of your coexistence experience. So this session is basically uniquely positioned for those that are planning on or potentially going to run hybrid for the foreseeable future.
Since you're running hybrid for a while, one of the things that I like to touch on first, either getting into hybrid or when we're running a long-term hybrid and we start having issues, is let's start looking at the network. And I'm going to touch on what could be a corner case, although if you're a financial services customer, this slide may be familiar to you, or at least the scenario. And what I find with some organizations is that everything needs to be redundant, not the organization, but everything in it. So with that, we've got redundant networks, we've got redundant fiber coming in and out of different parts of the building. And sometimes we have redundant ISPs. So we have dual network paths going out via different ISPs going towards the same firewall. And consider that we've got two DNS records pointing to the same firewall heading towards Exchange. And so the issue with that is if we have an inbound request, it needs to go to the right firewall eventually. And for that, often they have a hosted load balancer. And with that, the request either goes to one or the other ISP. Now, one of the points I'm going to make a number of times is that a network that is built for browsing is not the same network that's built to consume a cloud service. So let's put Office 365 into the mix. And we keep the same scenario, and things break. And the reason why they break is because we need something stateful between the two endpoints, coming from cloud to on-premises or on-premises to cloud. So if we have a variable network path, then we can expect that things get really weird really quickly. To reinforce the point that what's acceptable for browsing is not acceptable for cloud consumption, we can get away with a lot of things if all we're doing is browsing the internet. However, when we're consuming a cloud service, then network delays that used to be acceptable are no longer acceptable. Latency to your named endpoint, in this case, it could be outlook.office365.com, it could be the SharePoint namespace, it could be the Skype for Business namespace. That latency per workload should be as low as possible. And if you're running anything over 300 milliseconds, then you need to have an argument with your ISP, because you may find that if it takes 15 hops on a trace route to find the closest peering point for the Microsoft network, then that is unacceptable. You should be running at about 3 or 4 max. Proxy authentication, lots of us run large networks and we've got a proxy in between and it seems to be transparent, but often I find that when we're chasing down hybrid issues, either the firewall or the proxy is the first culprit that comes up. So even though the proxy appears to be transparent, it still adds latency to the chain. Now, TCP scaling is something that's been around since Windows 2003 onwards. And what TCP scaling allows us to do is take two Windows servers or two servers that know what TCP scaling is and negotiate a variable payload for the TCP window size, which means that for a given network speed, if TCP scaling is disabled, I will only ever have a finite amount of data that'll traverse the line. With TCP scaling enabled, I can have the two endpoints negotiate based on changing network conditions what that TCP window size would be. And where this impacts you really quickly is when you're moving a mailbox to Office 365 and it appears to be slow, even though you've got lots of bandwidth and your latency is low. Often we find that firewalls have got this switched off by default. Other things that we find is that Outlook does weird stuff. So I change a view from a folder to a shared calendar, and Outlook hangs, and it takes a little while. Or I get a random authentication prompt. I'm working, I'm not really doing anything different, and I suddenly get this auth prompt. Or active sync goes weird. And again, this goes back to this network is tuned for browsing. It's not tuned for consuming a cloud service. Because you'll notice that the firewall has got a timeout setting that is lower than the rest of the chain. Now, that's really good when we're browsing, because browsers consume stuff, they go to a website, and if the browser window is open, then you want to cut the session. However, if that's not a browser anymore and now it's Outlook, and that firewall cuts that session, then you get an auth prompt. So how do we fix that? Or how do we find that? Well, we need to find where it is in the chain, and then we need to fix it so that the firewall or the edge of your network is no longer the thing that is or has the shortest amount of time when it comes to keeping a session alive. Here we've got two people that are floating in the Indian Ocean, and they consume mail, which is not an uncommon scenario, because everyone needs a mailbox. What we're doing here is we're demonstrating two things. We're demonstrating the network capacity that exists between Office 365 data centers, and that network capacity is staggering. And so Tim could possibly throw some numbers at us, but we don't have a network constraint, really, between data centers at all. However, we also have lots of data centers. So depending on where you are in the world and depending where your tenant is in the world, what do you connect to? Because the only thing that you know is outlook.office365.com. But that's actually a catch-all DNS term behind which are a lot of data centers. But there's a problem on this slide. The problem is that my IT department decides that we are not going to use root hints for DNS. I see there's a bit of a chuckle happening in the audience. This has happened to some of you before. So we're not using root hints for DNS resolution. What could possibly go wrong? So we go to Google, and Google says, I know where you are. You're in the Pacific Northwest. Even though I'm floating in the Indian Ocean, you're in the Pacific Northwest. So I'm going to return the data center that I think is closest to you, which is in the Pacific Northwest. So what do you think is going to happen? Well, we're going to connect to the Pacific Northwest, even though my mailbox is in Europe. Office 365 will accept the request, figure out where your mailbox is actually mounted, which is somewhere in Europe, throw it over the amazing network that we have, and these latency times aren't indicative of what would happen in real life. What they are indicative of is that I have this long route to where my mailbox actually is, and that adds latency onto every single transaction within Outlook. So often, I run into call center deployments, and it's like, why is Outlook so slow? And we've only got like 40 milliseconds to office365.com. And then we found that GeoDNS, and Lily said something rude there, GeoDNS has upset the apple cart. So we need to be secure because, you know, Exchange out of the box is dangerous and it's insecure and exposes your network to attack. Not really, though. But that's what our security people tell us. And so then we come along with this hybrid thing. And now that we take this hybrid server, this dangerous hybrid server, we need to publish it securely behind the four layers of firewall and proxy logic and everything else. And we have to ask ourselves a question. And right now, when we're introducing a change to the network, this is a good time to, again, upset the apple cart and say, do we really need to do what we're doing? Why are we still running TMG? Or why are we running a reverse proxy that gives us pre-authentication in a hybrid scenario, because it adds absolutely no value. So the question here is, do we really need something to publish Exchange? And the answer is no. Because if we look at how Office 365 is published, we go from the firewall to the load balancer to Exchange. And yes, there may be an IPS in between, but we don't have many layers of publishing. The other thing I hear from customers is that, well, I throw up a hybrid mode server, and I go into hybrid mode, and I need to secure the traffic so that only Office 365 can talk to my hybrid mode server. Okay, that's a fair ask, depending on your compliance requirements. But then how do we do that? We can do that in one of two ways. If we use a current generation firewall, you'll go and subscribe to a very famous RSS feed. And that RSS feed updates on a semi-regular basis, and you'll go and do a regular maintenance slot on your firewall and add those ranges as they appear to your firewall so that only the ranges in which you find Azure AD and Office 365 and the rest of Azure that could somehow touch Office 365 will talk to your firewall and nothing else. Or we can secure this using a next-gen firewall that knows what a namespace is. So it'll only allow traffic that comes in from star.outlook.com, star.sharepoint.com, to traverse to and from your firewall, as opposed to this monolithic set of ACLs. Now, you may guess which one I prefer. So I would prefer the next-gen firewall because it's less work for me when I have to take a phone call from my customer who says, we did this stuff, but for a week, things have been random until the RSS feed updates, and all of a sudden, oh, there's a new Netcrit range that popped up, and that explains why we had some of our clients disconnecting. Now, if there's any compliance officers in the room, I apologize in advance. When we start having a cloud discussion, we often threaten things, and we threaten the status quo. And these are some of the quotes that I've had from customers. We trust some of Office 365, but not all of Office 365, because auto-discover will expose our network to the world and people will read our data. Active Sync is insecure. I'll let you go hybrid, but I need to be able to sniff all the traffic for all the mailboxes that I put up into the cloud. I'm not lying. These are actually conversations I've had with customers. And then I have to say, it's not really possible because it's out there and you hear and we can't get a probe in there. Or the compliance officer will say, well, Microsoft isn't compliant to our framework. And then I have to ask, which one? And there's a lot of iteration around education and patience. And then we unpack the compliance piece, which is actually arguably the easiest ones, because I'll say, which one of the 28 current certifications that Microsoft is compliant to do you need for your business? And we've got national clouds. So in-country clouds in Germany, China, and US government. But wait, there's more. Because if we sign an NDA with Microsoft, we can get access to stuff that Microsoft will give you the results of pen tests and audits and the kind of openness that we don't get from other vendors. So this is very much a trust discussion, not a technical discussion. Over to you, Hindog.
All right. So, how many people have heard of ExpressRoute? How many people have configured ExpressRoute? More than I expected, but a lot less. You've heard of it. It's only a few have configured it. How many people are actually interested in using ExpressRoute? Okay, a good number. So the idea of ExpressRoute is basically it gives you all these wonderful things that marketing tells you it gives you. It gives you a private connection, gives you between on-premises and Office 365 for a specific set of URLs. It gives you lower latency. It meets certain security compliance requirements and so on and so forth. This session is not about all the ins and outs and benefits of ExpressRoute. There is a session tomorrow. I'm going to call out in a minute here for ExpressRoute. But I just wanted to talk about what ExpressRoute means for a hybrid configuration, when you can use ExpressRoute and when you can't. There's been a lot of confusion of, well, I want ExpressRoute because it sounds awesome, so let's go ahead and go for ExpressRoute. Can I use it for hybrid? And our content is easy to read because it doesn't exist for hybrid so far. So it's coming. But anyway, so to answer that question, we wanted to take at least a couple slides to talk about when you can and cannot use ExpressRoute. So I guess it all starts with, when can you use ExpressRoute? Technically, you can use ExpressRoute for any protocol you want, okay? The challenge is, you have to decide if you want that URL that you're accessing for that protocol. For instance, the autodiscover URL, autodiscover.contoso.com. Is that URL something that you need accessible from external? If it's something you need accessible from external, not just from Office 365, then that URL cannot be part of an express route. So you can't add it to the pool. So when you're thinking about the flows of how hybrid works, you have to decide if a certain URL can or cannot be express route, okay? So, federation. Federation is what we use, OAuth, all these server-to-server things that we use for things like FreeBSY. These are things that we use for cross-premises e-discovery. All of these things connect to both the auto-discover and the EWS endpoint on-premises, okay? If you are using Federation, FreeBSY, all those features, you can completely use ExpressRoute, okay? That you can publish your auto-discover and EWS URLs through ExpressRoute, no problem, okay? Now, mail flow. If you have centralized mail flow, and the only external folks that need to actually, the only time Office 365 needs to hit your on-premises environment through SMTP is, the only traffic that's gonna hit it is from your Office 365 environment because you have centralized mail flow configured, then you can use that URL through ExpressRoute. If you want external folks to be able to send directly to to the on-premises environment, then you cannot use ExpressRoute. The point is that you have to decide if you want external access to that endpoint or not. So most folks will not be able to use ExpressRoute for mail flow because of that. It is possible that most folks won't be able to use it. So then you have to think internal clients. So I have Mac, I have Windows, I have Outlook, I have all these devices that might be managed through some type of internal utility connecting to my my on-premises environment. I don't allow anybody from their home or from Starbucks or not connected through a VPN or direct access to access my environment. In that case, then all of your endpoints for OWA, ActiveSync, and all the things that you would use can be published through ExpressRoute because there's no need, there's no external folks accessing it. But as soon as you have external access to those endpoints, as soon as you have people accessing OWA, externally, you need to make sure that that URL is not published through ExpressRoute. If they're accessing public folders, hybrid public folders, well, now you need Outlook Anywhere published to ExpressRoute. You can't have Outlook Anywhere published to ExpressRoute. If you have external clients connecting, you are essentially taking those protocols that those clients use out of ExpressRoute. You have to make a decision. Do I want that URL to be ExpressRoute only, or do I want it to be open to everybody? Okay. That's the decision you have to make. So can you use ExpressRoute in hybrid? The answer is yes, but you are limited, okay? More information on ExpressRoute is available in a session tomorrow. It's a session dedicated to ExpressRoute. So there was a lot of hands up, so I expect that a lot of you will be interested in it, so you might wanna jot down the session title. All right, how many people have multi-fars configured? Man, we're starting the morning out with ExpressRoute, with multi-fars, talking about networks right out the gate. They had pretty good eggs this morning. I'm pretty sure this is a rough way to start a Wednesday morning. So I'm gonna apologize ahead of time for talking multi-fars to you. How many people have Exchange 2010 that they would like to introduce into a multi-forest environment? Okay, oh, a couple in the back, I think, but not many. All right, so one of the things we've added, we've had multi-forest for hybrid configurations for a little while now, since Exchange 2013 SP1, and it's actually worked since Exchange 2013 CU4, and it's actually worked since Exchange 2013 CU8. So yeah, we made some progress. We got it to actually work. It was really out for 4 months or for four revisions without working. What are the things you have to do to get multi-forest hybrid working? First thing you have to do is prepare your organizations. And by prepare your organizations, I mean you have to install the latest versions of Exchange. I know it will work with CU8, but you know, obviously we don't support CU8. With hybrid configurations, we require that all your servers be at N-1, so you are at the latest version or the previous version. So obviously you would be at least CU13 now. So you'd make sure you get all your servers up to the latest version there, or if you're running 2010, you get it to the latest versions of 2010. You make sure you have your valid public certificates, all that stuff, which is all normal for having an on-premises environment, so nothing tricky there. And then you make sure that if you have ADFS and you have one instance of ADFS, that you have a trust between your on-premises environments, a two-way trust. The only time you really need that two-way trust is if you're planning on deploying identity federation, one instance of it for both on-premises organizations. Outside of that, you do not need to have the two-way forest trust. All right, next thing you need to set up is make sure you have configured is if you want mail flow between the on-premises organizations, this is something that the hybrid wizard will not do for you. In all likelihood, if you have a multi-forest configuration, you already have your on-premises mail flow configured in the way you want it to be configured. But if you do not have it configured already, that would be something that you would have to knock out on your own because it is outside of the scope of the hybrid wizard. The hybrid wizard is meant to get your on-premises organizations working with Office 365. Not to get your on-premises organizations working together. Okay? Our goal is to get you to the cloud, not to another on-prem organization. So. AD Sync, ooh, I put the wrong name in there. AD Connect is what that should say. You have to install AD Connect. A lot of times people even get confused about how many instances of AD Connect do I need? Do I need to install AD Connect in each forest? There's only one instance of AED Connect for your organization. If you have one forest, if you have two, if you have three, if you have five, you install one instance of AED Connect. That AED Connect instance will make a connection with a management agent connection to your Office 365 environment, and then one additional management agent connection to each of your on-premises environments. Okay? So you need one instance of AED Connect so that you can pull in all the attributes into one metaverse and push them up to Office 365. We do not coordinate between multiple deployments of AAD Connect. Run the hybrid wizard. This is the easy part. There's a whole lot of stuff you got to do before you run the hybrid wizard and a whole lot of stuff you got to do after. We've done the middle part really well. We've gotten the hybrid wizard knocked out. So you just basically run the hybrid wizard in each forest. When you run the hybrid wizard, there's a couple nuances we're going to talk about in a few minutes, but essentially you just run the hybrid wizard in Forest 1, select your unique namespace in Forest 1 while you're running it, and you do the same thing in Forest 2, and then you have your multi-forest hybrid configured. What it will configure is it'll configure your FreeBusy so that you can have it'll configure your federation so that you can have FreeBusy. It will configure your mail flow between on-premises and Office 365. You'll essentially have that hybrid configuration between those two organizations and Office 365. And then configure ADFS. And that's an optional step. You could use AAD Sync as well. Okay, so. Oh, and one other step I almost forgot about was configuring your organization relationships. We, by default, do configure your org relationships between on-prem and the cloud, but if you want to share FreeBusy between the two on-premises organizations, you likely already had it configured, but if you didn't, you have to manually configure the org relationships between Fabricam and Contoso, because again, we don't set up that relationship. We only set it up between on-prem and the cloud. All right, some of the golden rules. I'm going to go through these somewhat quickly because these are not new rules. These are things that have been out there a long time with this multi-forest configurations, and they're all documented on TechNet. So I don't need to spend a lot of time on these. But each organization needs a unique SMTP address. So if you share a namespace, contoso.com or something, each organization needs a unique namespace. The reason we need that unique namespace is so that things like Mailflow and FreeBusy can be configured and we can get those things routed correctly. So when somebody on-premises is looking up FreeBusy for a cloud user, it can't look up the cloud user by querying ted@contoso.com or something like that. It has to query something unique that gets it to the cloud, that gets that request to the cloud. And that's why in the cloud, what we do is we use the namespace of contoso.mail.onmicrosoft.com. Okay? So we set up the target address for Ted, his mailbox that's been moved to the cloud, to ted@contoso.mail.onmicrosoft.com. No on-premises environment's going to have that. It's a unique namespace that we can route for FreeBSY. It's a unique namespace that we can route for MailFlow. Similarly, on-premises, you have to do the same thing. If you're in Contoso and you're sharing that namespace, you can't have another organization with a target address of Contoso because it won't know how to route over to that other organization. So you need that unique namespace, okay? The other big one that I think a lot of people miss is, I already talked about some of these, which is why I'm skipping ahead. But the other big one that other people miss is that FreeBSY is not transitive. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more later. But what that means is just because if I set up an organization relationship with an on-premises entity, it doesn't mean that I'm going to be able to see FreeBSY for that cloud entity once they move the mailbox to the cloud. We'll get more into that discussion later. The other thing that people sometimes miss is that you need a third-party certificate for MailFlow, but you need a unique certificate for each organization. So you can't have the same TLS certificate in organization A and organization B and expect MailFlow to work. The reason why is part of our TLS arbitration uses that third-party certificate information to basically authenticate your mail. And you cannot share that same certificate information with two different environments, okay? You can't have that two certificate information in two on-premises environments. So you can't add a bunch of namespaces to one certificate and put it in both on-prem orgs. You need two unique certificates, okay? It's a common mistake people make when they're doing multi-forest. The other thing I get asked a lot is, can you go multi-forest with multiple tenants? Meaning, can I have an on-prem organization, a single organization on-premises, and can I go to two tenants, okay? Migrate half my users to Europe and half my users to a tenant in the US, something like that. The answer is, technically, you can have two tenants, but not in hybrid. You have to pick which tenant you want to go hybrid to. So you can have, you can set up AAD Connect to sync half your users to the Europe tenant and half your users to the US tenant. But then you would have to pick, do I want to go hybrid with US or do I want to go hybrid with Europe? You cannot go hybrid with two tenants. Mail routing, the biggest thing with mail routing, we've already talked about the unique namespace, so I'm not going to go into that again. But the biggest thing with mail routing is this last bullet here. When you have multiple on-premises organizations, you could potentially have a tim@contoso.com in one organization, and you could have a tim@foo.com in the other organization, okay? There is a potential that you have more than one Tim and that you have a pretty generic naming convention, okay? So if you have that, what happens is when you synchronize them to Office 365, they're both going to potentially have the same target address, okay? So the target address would be tim@contoso.mail.onmicrosoft.com. But you can't have two users with the same target address, okay? So one of the things you have to make sure you do when you set up multi-forest is you need to make sure that you update your email address policy to ensure uniqueness of those names. So what we kind of give a recommendation here, you could do it however you'd like, but what we do here is it would be tim.contoso@contoso.mail.onmicrosoft.com in one forest, and the other forest, the email address policy would be tim.fabricam. Make sense? The other issue, if you're going with 2010 multi-forest, we have another caveat. This caveat is a little bit harder to deal with, but basically if you have a shared namespace, let's say you're going multi-forest and you have 2010 and you have a shared namespace, you will run into issues where an on-premises user cannot look up a cloud user's FreeBSY. And the reason why that is the way 2010 works when it's requesting a FreeBSY token. So I'm going to skip ahead to kind of show what that looks like. So let's say Ben is looking up Ted's FreeBSY. When Ben looks up Ted's FreeBSY, It's going to send the request via EWS or via OWA API to the client access server or the server running the availability service. Okay? In this case, because it's 2010, it would be a client access server. Okay? When the client access server looks, it says, oh, Ted's free. Ted's a user that's not local. I need to go and get free busy for Ted. I'm going to go and get a delegation token for Ted. When it's getting that delegation token, it's going to request it on behalf of the user that's requesting the free busy information. In this case, it's the on-premises user. The on-premises user's primary SMTP address would be something like, you know, ben@kentoso.com. So it's going to request from the Federation Gateway a delegation token that's valid for that primary SMTP address. Okay. Once the Federation Gateway returns it, there will be a claim in that token that has that information in there. And then the client access server will send the request over to Office 365, Exchange Online specifically, saying, hey, I need to get free busy for Ted. The challenge is when you have multiple forests and you create organization relationships in the cloud for these multiple on-premises forests, you can't add Kentoso.com to both organization relationships. You can only add it to one. So if you ran the hybrid wizard, let's say from Fabricam first, it would add Kentoso.com to that organization relationship. If you later ran the hybrid wizard from I don't know which one I said first, Fabricam and then Kentoso, the default domain or that SMTP domain would then be added to the Kentoso organization relationship. So it will be added to whichever organization relationship was created last. So anybody that was now in Fabricam would not be able to see free busy information because that domain name has been removed from that organization relationship. In 2013, it's not an issue because we have a concept of a default domain for the Federation Trust. But in 2010, it is an issue because we do not have that concept. Okay? So the solution for this, so that your on-premises users can see cloud users free busy, is to go to your on-premises Federation Trust and remove the actually I have a couple solutions written on the next slide, but one of the solutions is to go to the on-premises Federation Trust and remove the shared namespace from the Federation Trust. If you remove the shared namespace and keep just the unique namespaces, then your free busy request from 2010 will work. Again, this is not something that matters from 2013, but it does matter from 2010. All right. Now, this is something that came up yesterday. How many people have heard of the hybrid mesh? I've sent it in a few emails to people before. So the hybrid mesh is when kind of show you like this. Let's say you have three organizations. You have Kentoso, Tailspin, and Fabricam, okay? And they're all on-premises, okay? They're probably the last three on-premises customers, right? Isn't that what we saw yesterday? No. So they share free busy information between each other. And they're running happy as ever. They're good to go. They can see free busy between organizations. They have good relationships. Awesome. And then one day, Kentoso decides to go hybrid. When Kentoso goes hybrid and starts moving their mailboxes to the cloud, all of a sudden, the Fabricam and Tailspin users cannot see free busy information anymore. You've basically broken these relationships. Now, the Fabricam and Tailspin users can still see free busy for anybody you haven't moved to Office 365, but anybody you've moved to the service, all of a sudden, they can't see their free busy anymore. Okay? Obviously, this is a problem for these types of organizations. So, what do you do? You have to decide if you want to go hybrid or if you want to keep those relationships in place. That was kind of the standard answer, right? It just didn't work. Now, there is a workaround for it, and the workaround is probably more messy than saying pick hybrid or, you know, or your partners. But anyway, we're going to go through the workaround here. When Ben's looking up free busy for Ted, we're using kind of the same equation here. You have an on-premises user in Kentoso looking up free busy for a Fabricam user that's been moved to Office 365, Ted. Okay, When that happens, that free busy request goes to the client access server or the mailbox server or whatever server, depending on the version of Exchange you're using, whatever servers run in the availability service, okay? That client access server will then say, okay, I see that this is a remote user. I need to get a delegation token for this user. Once he goes and gets the delegation token for the user to the Federation Gateway or the Azure Auth server, it will return a delegation token back to the client access server. This delegation token that we received is valid for the on-premises Fabricam environment. Okay, so we went to the delegation Microsoft Federation Gateway, got a delegation token that will only be authorized in the on-premises Fabricam environment. Once we get that delegation token back, we send a free busy request because the user that you're looking for is ted@contoso.com. We send the free busy request over to the on-premises Fabricam environment. Okay? Once that happens, the Fabricam environment says, oh, I know the user, but he's been moved to Office 365. His target address is contoso.mail.allmicrosoft.com. Okay? So he tells the requesting server, hey, that mailbox has been moved. You need to go and, you know, request free busy there. The client access server in the on-premises environment will then not go out and get a new delegation token, and because it does not go out and get a new delegation token, it will not be able to see free busy for that user. The idea here is that free busy is not transitive. You need to make sure that the first time you hit an organization, an external organization, to see the free busy of a user, that you are hitting the right organization. You need to get to the right place the first time. So how do you do that? Basically, what you need to do is you need to sync the GAL between your on-premises environments. What that means is if a user in TED is on-premises, his email address is ted@contoso.com. That would sync over to the other organization. If the user is moved to Office 365, his new address, target address, should be ted@contoso.mail.allmicrosoft.com, the new routing address. That needs to be synced to the other organization. Once you synchronize it to the other organization, you can then create a separate org relationship for that unique namespace that points to the cloud, and that would allow the free busy to hit the right place the first time. So essentially what would happen is you would look up free busy for TED. When you look up free busy for TED, the client access server would see that there is a contact for TED with the proper target address because you've synchronized that user, okay? Once it looks up that proper target address, it will go to the Federation Gateway. It will get a Azure Auth token that is valid for Exchange Online in this case. Return that to the requester. They will go request free busy information with the proper token this time, and free busy will work. Okay. It's a messy workaround. A lot of customers already have directory synchronization between their on-premises environments, so it's not a huge deal for them. If you don't have directory synchronization, FIM configured between your on-premises environments, then it becomes another 3-month project for you. Some of you can bill for that, though, so that might be a good thing. Back over to you.
So mergers and acquisitions and hybrid mode. What could possibly go wrong? He clicks back instead of forward. That's one of them. Okay. So one of three scenarios. You are as happy as a pig in mud. That's not a scenario. This is the state of life. However, you are an on-prem customer, and mergers and acquisitions says, we've just bought this other shop, and they're an Exchange hybrid. So what do you do? Or you're in the cloud, and you're quite happy in the cloud, you're all in the cloud, and now you're given an on-premises addition to your real estate. Or you're in the cloud, and you've sold off part of yourself, and now you need to split. So what do? Tim's spoken to multi-forest hybrid, so the first two are nicely answered. The last one is a little bit more complicated, because it's a tenant-to-tenant migration. And if you remember the golden rules are a little bit like physics. They're immutable. You can't argue with them. Once they're established, you can't change it. So a namespace can only exist in one tenant at a time, as an example. And I'm going to talk about planning a little bit, since if we have 30 users and we're splitting, or if we have 3,000 users or we're splitting, that's a lot of desktop real estate that we don't want to touch, which means that if we're going to migrate, we want to migrate and preserve mailbox GUIDs, which means if I preserve a mailbox GUID, my OST, wherever that is, as the end result of a migration, isn't rebuilt, and that means I don't have a desktop touch. So we've spoken about the UPN namespaces, but the UPN namespaces that we have on premises are registered domains that we have within our tenants. Now, those registered domains, from an Active Directory point of view, are authentication namespaces, but from an SMTP point of view, are transport namespaces. So we need to keep that in mind. And in our tenant, they're both. What we can do is we can use the free namespaces that we get within Office 365. So the star.mail.onmicrosoft.com and the star.onmicrosoft.com that we can use for transport and authentication. But now, if we're using those as forwarding namespaces for SMTP, that's fine. But if we're using them to authenticate, then all of a sudden, we probably have had to touch a desktop. Now, 2 days ago, I did speak to a vendor in the exhibition hall who said that they can do this, tenant-to-tenant migration, with no downtime. Absolutely none. So we know that this can be done with third-party tools, but if you don't have third-party tools in your budget, then if you want to do a cutover migration, so a big bang, or if you want to do a gradual migration, so you trickle a couple of users at a time, then you may need to consider using extra namespaces to get this done. But since we probably want to coexist our users for a while and we don't want to touch the desktops, The easiest way forward is to do a reverse hybrid, to take them back on-prem and then go back into hybrid mode again. So we take that subset of users, we take them back to on-premises, and then we take them back into the cloud. So how hard can this possibly be? And I blame Tim for that Akinator tools. So tenant-to-tenant migration. And this is a summary. First, remembering our namespaces. Our namespaces can only exist at one place at a time in terms of actually using them. However, I need to be able to authenticate with them on premises. So I need to add my UPN namespace to my forest. Otherwise, I can't authenticate. Maybe I don't have Exchange anymore. Maybe I'm raising a new forest, so I need to install Exchange. And then I need to consider transport. So everything I'm using in Office 365 in terms of transport needs to exist on premises as well. Then I create the placeholder objects, the mail-enabled users that represent what I have in cloud. This is all my objects, resources, groups, users, and I associate the MS Exchange mailbox GUID for the mailbox-enabled users I have in cloud to the mail-enabled users that I have on-premises. Why do I need to do that? If I don't do that and I initiate a remote mailbox move, the two mailboxes don't know where to go, or the one mailbox doesn't know what to align with on-premises. So Exchange matches our users using the MS Exchange mailbox GUID and does a mailbox migration, which is also an online mailbox move for those of us who've done anything forest to forest. And the reason why we want the GUID in there is that because it preserves the OST, which is our prime coexistence requirement. Then we run the hybrid configuration wizard to establish a relationship back to our tenant. We use directory sync to create the Active Directory glue that we need in between those two. And then we point auto discover back to on-prem. That's a quick bullet. We move our mailboxes back to on-premises. So that's going to take as long as it takes, because here we can't argue with physics or the speed of your network connection. So we've moved all our mailboxes. You need to point our MX records for that domain or the set of domains that we've split out back to on-premises. We decommission hybrid mode, deactivate sync for Active Directory, and if we've finished with our tenant, bear in mind this could be a divestiture or this could be an offboarding, but the same logic applies. So if we are finished with a tenant altogether, we turn down the tenant. What do we do next? Well, now we can either park our mailboxes on premises because we've divested, or we go back online to a new Office 365 tenant. Now, to add a little bit of controversy to the room, we're going to talk about hybrid namespaces. So hybrid namespaces are a technical solution for a political problem. And Tim hates these. And he's rather vocal about how much he doesn't like them.
What's that now?
How much you don't like hybrid namespaces.
Oh, hybrid namespaces. Yeah, this is a great idea. Are you an advocate of this namespace?
That's not what I said. I said it's a technical solution to a political problem. Can we make an election joke now? So what is a hybrid namespace? So let's assume you've got your Exchange org nicely wrapped up, and remembering the compliance people that we spoke about earlier that said, you can do some stuff, but not other stuff. And I've got 40 layers worth of firewalls, and I'm publishing Exchange through, and I've got a tight schedule, and I've got to move mailboxes now. So what do? Well, I do that thing, which is a hybrid namespace. And the hybrid namespace effectively is a set of Exchange servers with a different namespace. So that namespace is an HTTP and an SMTP namespace that is split off from the rest of your organization, which represents hybrid mode servers. Now, there's a problem with that. If you introduce servers that are a newer version than what you already have, where does Autodiscover point to? The new thing. Okay, so what are we actually achieving here? We're achieving more complexity. We are kind of achieving a result. And I've got another slide on when I get to talk about how do we patch hybrid mode servers a little bit later that describes this problem in detail. So you may be using this as a technical mechanism to overcome a political problem, or you may decide that you're going to accelerate the speed of your migration by introducing lots of extra namespaces. But there's a problem with that, and the problem is that Office 365 will throttle you globally across the number of migrations that you're running. So it doesn't matter if you add 100 namespaces, you're still going to have the same throttling limit that applies.
The other thing to think about with namespaces, I say vote no to namespaces, by the way. They're not fantastic, they're not huge, they're nothing, okay?
Hashtag say no to namespaces.
You basically, when you run through the hybrid wizard, you are doing a set of organization configurations, okay? When your users are connecting to C3 Busy, they're not going to a specific hybrid server. They're
I've going, got that on another slide, by the way.
They're going. Oh. You do have that on
the. I do have it on the.
Forgot about that.
But carry on. It sounds
anyway,
good.
They don't go from a specific server. They go to whatever server that mailbox is living on. Right. That's where the requests are going to come from. When you configure mail, when you're running through the hybrid wizard and you select your servers for receiving mail, if you pick two 2013 servers, now your whole organization is all your whole 2010 organization is receiving mail on those two 2013 servers. Well, you didn't size it correctly. You sized 2013 correctly. So stop doing hybrid servers for illegitimate reasons or because somebody who knows nothing about the technology said, politically, it's got to be done this way. There's plenty of arguments against it. Make sure that there's a darn good reason for doing it before doing it, because you're adding unnecessary complexity. Now, the other one that aggravates a lot of people is, yeah, I'm going to move to Office 365. So I'm going to set up a hybrid configuration. I'm going to toss all my tenants in the cloud. We all know how easy that is because he just covered it. So I'm going to toss all my tenants and all my users in the cloud. And now I'm going to be full hybrid. I'm going to get rid of my on-premises Exchange server. How many people want to get rid of their on-premises Exchange server or have heard people want to get rid of their on-premises Exchange server after moving all their users? Okay. There's other circumstances. How many people have have Lotus Notes on premises? A small number of hands, but I'm telling you, that's a lot of users underneath those hands. Okay, these organizations never had Exchange on premises. They're really pissed about moving. These administrators are really pissed about moving to an Exchange product in the cloud. But they're at least saying, you know what? At least I don't have to install Exchange. I don't have to touch that server. And the reality is you do, okay? The reality is you have to have Exchange to manage your recipients in the cloud if you want directory synchronization enabled. I don't know many organizations that can go without directory synchronization. Okay, small organizations, sure, there's some cutover ones, I'm not talking about that, but any substantially sized organization is going to need password sync or identity federation or other reasons to keep directory synchronization around. Directory synchronization stays around, sadly your Exchange server stays around. I always jump ahead in slides before I get to them, but maintaining an Exchange server is not something, like I said, people want to do. People are trying to reduce their footprint. People are trying for simplification, trying to get all their users to the cloud and simplify things. And like I said, third parties. You're coming from Gmail to Office 365, and then we tell you you have to install an Exchange server. This is not something people want to hear. Now, it doesn't have to be a beefy one. You don't need a DAG. You don't need to hire Brian Reed to do mail flow configurations and all that stuff. You can just, you know, configure one server, pretty lightweight server. You get a free license for that server. So, I mean, there is some, it isn't a terrible story. It's our application for managing Exchange, right? But people don't want to hear it. But the reality is you need it, or you have to use unsupported methods like ADSiEdit or potentially third-party provisioning tools. Okay. So basically, the bars on this slide are just to indicate that the user is in prison. Once you get them in hybrid, they can't get out. There's no way to get out. Anyway, when do you need the Exchange server on premises? Do you need the Exchange server, like I said, if you have directory synchronization enabled? The only time you don't is if you don't have directory synchronization enabled. You need it really for a couple of attributes, which I'm going to cover on a later slide. But what are other reasons to keep Exchange servers on premises? Recipient management is definitely one of them, but then there's other factors that come into play. Some people use Exchange still for anonymous SMTP relay. So if they want like a printer, you know, things like that on premises, they can use those anonymous relays. If they have hybrid public folders is another reason. Okay. Some customers keep their Exchange public folders on premises because they have too many of them. Some customers don't have the clients that can connect to the modern public folders. Whatever it is, they're keeping public folders on premises. Maybe they can't move all their mailboxes yet, so they have to keep public folders on premises. So hybrid public folders is one reason people keep it on-prem. Ability to offboard. Some people want to make sure they have their out. Okay. The only native approach we have for offboarding mailboxes is through hybrid, through MRS-based moves, okay? So you need an Exchange server to be able to offboard. Some people want to make sure they keep that avenue open. So that's another reason to keep an Exchange server on-prem. And like I said, SMTP relay is another one. So it isn't just for recipient management. There could be other factors that you need to think about. And I'm sure I'm missing some. There's probably other examples that people could think of. So when do you keep Exchange and hybrid versus when do you keep Exchange but remove hybrid versus when do you remove Exchange and hybrid? Like I said, the only time you remove Exchange and the hybrid configurations, why did it go dark? I can see fine, so I'm just going to keep going.
It wasn't me.
It should be.
But I get to put Bashan on stage, which is pretty cool. No? Can we have an
MVP there we go.
For 200 points? Yay!
That's why we have the MVP up here. All right, remove Exchange and hybrid. You do that if you don't have DiraSync. I think most people have DiraSync, so that's not usually an option. Then you have the keep Exchange but remove hybrid. What that means is you don't need your federation features. You don't need your secure mail set up. You can disable your auto-discover on premises and point your auto-discover to the cloud, disable your service connection point. You can do things like point your MX record to the cloud. You are simply keeping one. You can remove all your Exchange servers except one, okay? You are simply keeping Exchange for recipient management. That is the second option up here. And then the first option up here is keep Exchange in hybrid. You would keep the hybrid configuration, the connectors and all that stuff, along with all your Exchange servers, or at least a portion of your Exchange servers, if you fell into the last buckets where you had you know, public folders, mail routing, or you had a need for mailboxes on premises, okay? So those are the options you have to kind of go through. This is, in case you don't like to read words, this is the chart with those same options. And there's also a TechNet article that covers this too, that doesn't have Orange in it if you're not a fan of Orange. So what are we considering? Are we considering getting rid of the need for the Exchange Admin Center? The answer is yes, we are considering it. Basically, there's four, when you have a user that's synchronized via Active Directory, there's four attributes that you cannot manage. Those four attributes are alias, which is the important one. You need to be able to set somebody's alias and email address. Hide from address list, which is relatively important. And then mail tips translation. How many people care about mail tips translation attribute? Yeah, it just happens to be one that, again, Brian is the only one that cares about because he's the only one that raised his hand. But the biggest one here is you can't manage even an email address without using ADSI Edit or some other method. So that's the challenge here, right? So we're going through a few options right now. We haven't landed on one yet. But one option is to allow the customer to pick their own source of authority, meaning once you've migrated all your users, you could flip a bit in the cloud that says, I want to manage my Exchange attributes in the cloud, maybe like a set organization configuration commandlet or something. There's one that would allow you to say, I want to allow those attributes to be written in either place and just let DirSync work it out, directory synchronization work it out. Okay, write it back to on-premises, kind of keep everything in sync. There's one that, there's one option of a dual write where we could update our commandlet infrastructure to write to both on-premises and Exchange Online. All these come with different levels of complexity. All these solve the problem for some customers and not all. So we're going through these different options and weighing them out. I don't have an announcement today. We don't have an answer today. So the announcement today is, just like it was yesterday, keep your Exchange server on-premises. If you don't have an Exchange server yet, go buy one. It's free. And install it. Shared mailbox provisioning. There's a lot of, how many people use shared mailboxes in here? Okay. And how many people know how to create a shared mailbox in the cloud correctly? So the correct way to create a shared mailbox in the cloud when you're in hybrid is to create the mailbox on premises, the shared mailbox on premises, and then move that shared mailbox to Office 365. What a lot of people do is they create a mailbox, they create a mailbox directly in the cloud, new remote mailbox. There's no shared switch on it, so they can't create a shared mailbox directly in the cloud. And then they convert it. They convert it to a shared mailbox. Once you convert it to a shared mailbox, what happens is you have a shared mailbox object in the cloud. But your recipient type on premises still thinks it's a user mailbox. So you run the risk that if we ever do like a full sync of that object, you run the risk of that user in the cloud being converted from a shared mailbox back to a user mailbox. But what's the cool thing about shared mailboxes? They don't need a license, right? So it's free. You get a free mailbox. It's awesome. When you have a user mailbox without a license, what happens to it? Goes away, it disappears, kind of like our screens did a little bit ago. It happened too soon, we had it all timed out. Anyway, so the idea is if you create the new remote mailbox and if you create the mailbox on premises as a shared mailbox and move it to the cloud, well, now you have the recipient type correct on-prem and in Office 365. So what if you want to convert a cloud mailbox to a shared mailbox? It's already in the cloud and you want to convert it to a shared mailbox. The old process was a nice 17-click process, and you would be able to convert it to a shared mailbox, okay? The challenge there is if you were to convert a regular mailbox to a shared mailbox, you'd have that same problem. In the cloud, it would be a shared mailbox. On-prem, the recipient type says it's a user mailbox. You run the risk of losing data, okay? So what did we do about it? So far, all we've done, or this is actually coming soon, but all we're doing about it is making converting a user mailbox to a shared mailbox easier. So we're going to get you into that state easier, where you have a divergence from what's on-prem and in the cloud. So this will work for a user that you've created in the cloud and they have an on-premises mail object. This will work. You can convert it directly into cloud, but you run the risk of overwriting it. So as much as I love Nino and the work he's doing here, I would say do not convert your mailboxes directly into cloud to a shared mailbox. What you want to do instead is, like I said, not convert it directly into cloud, move the mailbox back on premises, convert it to a shared mailbox, and then move it back to the cloud. And like I said, I actually had an animation for the user getting into the dumpster. So there you go. User hopped into the trash can, if you don't do it the right way. So this just talks about the converting the shared mailbox. Like I said, move it back, convert it, move it to the cloud again. Back over. We're going to do many awkward transitions.
It's only awkward if there's a silence. So let's talk about your father's hybrid mode. So you may have started with Exchange 2010. You rolled out ADFS 2, life is good. You've got Outlook 2010, life is still good. Then your users do a password reset, and life isn't so good anymore, because now they have an authentication prompt and they're confused. So not many people still live in that space, but there are a lot of Exchange 2010, there's a lot of ADFS 2s, there's some still old ways of directory synchronization. So let's look at the benefits. Try before you buy. So if you go to ADFS 3 from 2, one particular pane goes away, and that's auth for Outlook. If you're running Outlook 2013 and you're running ADFS 2, you will have an auth prompt. If you're running ADFS 3 and you tweak the registry, this registry tweak is enabled with Outlook 2016 by default, then you have single sign-on. So that's a huge benefit for our users. This is a bit of the French moment in the presentation. DirSync is dead. Long live AAD Connect. All of the multi-forest options that Tim spoke about earlier are directly enabled using only AAD Connect. All the cool new stuff is in AAD Connect. Now, if you are security-minded, then you may sit with the scenario of, well, I only want to synchronize the attributes that I need to provision Office and or Exchange Online and or SharePoint and or Link or any combination thereof. And I can only do that with a new version of AAD Connect. So let's talk about upgrading hybrid slides. Let's talk about upgrading hybrid servers. And this is the slide that we had a bit of a preview on. So the short answer is it depends. Now let's assume you're in Exchange 2010 and you're in hybrid mode. And someone runs up to you with a good idea of, let's put an Exchange 2013 or Exchange 2016 and upgrade our hybrid mode servers. You know, only the servers that are facing the internet and running hybrid mode, only those guys.
What's that? I can't hear you because of the echo.
I know, but the rest of the room can, so I'll just look at you meaningfully.
Yeah. The echo is weird up here.
So we put together this short chart which summarizes the process. So you're in Exchange 2010 hybrid. And are you happy? Now, this is not a state of mind. It's more, does your stuff work? And if it works, then stay in 2010. If you need a new feature, and you're really convinced that you need that new feature, and you decide that one of those features is multi-forest hybrid, or OAuth, or that we can now do secure mail using not a long ACL that's on a receive connector, but we can use a certificate, which is a huge sigh of relief to some of you who've had to rerun the wizard a couple of times every time there's a change or something changes in your network and you've got to go and redo those connectors. That in itself could be enough of a benefit to move. The simple answer is you move to a newer version of Exchange if you need to, if you see that there's enough of a benefit to go hybrid on newer servers. So let's talk about patching your hybrid real estate. You know, only those two servers that are in your hybrid namespace, The rules of engagement with Exchange and Hybrid are very simple. If you're running entirely on premises and you're not running hybrid mode, then you can run two cumulative updates behind and still stay in support. If you're running hybrid, then you are one release behind. Now, with what Tim explained to us earlier, if we are running hybrid mode, then all of our servers are in scope, every single one of them, for availability space lookups, right? So a request comes into CAS, client access server. That client access server has the right to refer to any other client access server in your organization, which means by default, every single one of those servers takes part in hybrid, which means that all of them, if you're running hybrid mode, need to stay one CU behind at maximum. But what if I'm running a multi-data center with a complicated DAG scenario and my real estate is really complicated? It doesn't mean anything. Having hybrid doesn't change any of the patching rules which you use to patch Exchange today. And Tim would like you to remember via the footnote on the bottom right of this slide that there's no such thing as a darn hybrid server.
All right, this is something I've been getting a lot of questions about too, cross-premises permissions. This is basically one of those scenarios where you basically have a customer. The customer experience is, Tom is a delegate. Sarah's the CEO. Both mailboxes are on premises. They're humming along just fine. Everybody's happy. All of a sudden, Mike jumps in and says, "All right, I'm going to move the mailbox for Tom to Office 365. They're in a hybrid configuration. So now the mailbox is being moved. Great. Suddenly, Sarah notices some things aren't working with delegation. She can't access the mailbox, getting a million prompts, all kinds of issues start showing up. Sarah is not happy. We were not allowed to make the slides R-rated, so we changed some of the words to protect the innocent. So what comes next? Mike scrambles and says, what the heck is going on? I thought this hybrid thing, you know, when you move a mailbox from on-prem to the cloud, everything just works. Mike checks out Bing and then Google and finds out that cross-premises permissions aren't supported. It was buried in an article in TechNet. Let me rephrase. It was available in an article in TechNet, not buried. The quick answer here is Mike realizes, oh, I just need to move all of my managers and delegates that access each other's mailboxes at the same time. Oh, and I need to do the same thing for shared mailboxes. Okay, that should be easy to do. We have 400 managers, we have this many delegates, we have thousands of shared mailboxes, so we'll just move them all at one time. Has anybody used MRS? Has anybody done a hybrid migration? Okay, that uses MRS. And can you move thousands of mailboxes at one time? Sure. You're saying no. What kind of consultant are you? So we told them they can move at their own pace, and they can, as long as it's our pace and all at the same time and using technologies that don't exist. So this is the challenge we face, right? We know people have these relationships between each other. We know there's shared mailboxes. We know there's delegate mailboxes. So how do we handle this? How do we get people to, how do we get our heads around this? Well, we document it, right? We document it and say it's not supported, it doesn't work. That didn't work. It's not reasonable to move all the mailboxes at the same time. You know, moves break delegations without warning. So you're moving a mailbox, you're not told, hey, you know, your delegation's not gonna work. So you're expecting it to work. So all of a sudden it just, you know, you could even assign permissions and those permissions get assigned without giving you a warning. So you think they're working, but they're really not. So kind of an annoying little thing. And calling support, calling this unsupported is not a solution to the problem. We all know that. So what are the common access scenarios that we face? There's full mailbox access, which is when you open another user's mailbox in your profile. There's full mailbox access with auto mapping, where when you're too lazy to open another user's mailbox in your profile, it'll automatically add it in your profile for you. There is send as permissions, which is basically a set of recipient permissions, and then there's send on behalf of permissions, which is essentially handled through attribute management, okay? So there's four different core scenarios that we have for shared mailboxes, or for sharing scenarios. The additional one is the inability to actually use Outlook to manage those shared, these sharing configurations. So we've gotten feedback. We use user voice to get some of this feedback. When you search for hybrid, it was the number one piece of feedback we got that customers wanted. Luckily, I searched on hybrid and not delegation because it was spelled incorrectly, but we still found it. So what works? Full access, I'm gonna go through these kind of quickly in the interest of time. Full access just works. You can move your mailboxes from on-prem to online, it doesn't matter. If you want to access somebody's mailbox and you grant them full access, you can open it in your Outlook profile. Full access with auto mapping, I'm gonna skip the animations, but basically if you move a mailbox, if your mailbox is in the same premises, it works. If your mailbox is in a different premises, it does not work. So what needs to be fixed for this? We need to be able to write back your MS Exchange delegate list link from on-premises, from the cloud back to on-premises. We need to basically keep those in sync. And we need to allow the MS Exchange delegate list link to be updated on a mail-enabled user object. That is the technical challenge with this one and why it does not work. Send on behalf of, again, if you grant a mailbox send on behalf of and then move them to the cloud, that will work. If you grant a mailbox that is in a separate premises, it will not. The reason why this does not work, I'm going to kind of go down to what we need. The reason why this does not work is because we don't keep MS Exchange public delegates in sync, and we don't have ACLable MEUs, the same thing I was just talking about in the previous issue. You need to be able to have an MEU in the cloud that's ACLable so that you can set certain permissions on it, and you need to keep the MS Exchange public delegates in sync. I'm skipping through these quickly in the interest of time, like I said, but the idea that I want you to get from this is that we know all these scenarios that you need. We know what the technical issues are, like send as. We know you can get around it by doing add AD permissions in one forest and add recipient permissions in another forest, okay? There's ways around these things, and we know what the challenges are, so we know what we have to address, but we were trying to address these all at the same time before. We considered cross-premises permissions to be one big bucket, and we wanted to solve it all at once. What we're doing now is we're taking them out one by one and taking the easiest ones we can solve and solving those to try to remove blockers from some customers, and we'll work our way through the list. So we're taking it serious. We're going after it. There's the full access works today. Send as, send on behalf of is something we're still working on, as well as auto mapping. But we know what the challenges are, we know how to overcome them, we have a plan for overcoming them, and now it's a matter of getting some dev resources to address them. So it's what we're hoping to do here over the next couple months. Cross-premises delegation, like I said, the other thing we need to do is update mail-enabled user objects to be ACLable. And what I mean by that is when you try to access and set permissions, what I meant by that is when you try to access and set permissions on your mailbox, on your calendar, on your wherever it is, you go and try to add a recipient. If that recipient is not a mailbox in the same premises, so if you're a cloud user and it's not another mailbox in the cloud, you basically get the symbol that shows you cannot add that user because they cannot be ACLed, okay? And that's basically the challenge you need to overcome. So I am going to, I kind of talked about all these potential workarounds, so I am going to end the session now in the interest of time. And before we end it, I'm going to ask if there's any questions anybody has. It has to be a quick question, though. All right, so we're going to be at the booth later today. There's also a session on hybrid later today as well. It's going to be what's coming in the new hybrid configuration wizard. It's also going to talk about some best practices for migration. So if you want to see what's coming in the next, actually on Saturday, in the new hybrid wizard, you'll want to come to that session. We'll also talk about what we're planning over the next few months. So thanks, everybody.
Thank you very much.